Production. Recorded live.
Welcome and thank you for tuning in. You're listening to the Beyond 50 radio program. I'm Daniel Davis. Today we're going to be talking about something that can be an extremely sensitive topic, especially for the listeners out there who may have had at least 1 to 2 degrees of separation from the experience simply known as suicide. It certainly affects people in ways that maybe perhaps they don't have somebody that they directly were involved with, but it certainly has its ripple effect. On the program today, we're going to be talking with a psychotherapist who has more than 30 years of experience. She's a teacher of meditation, intuition, development, and psycho-spiritual issues. She also conducts international workshops and facilitates as an energy healer. She's also been the director of outpatient treatment at Liberation Clinic as well. Her work focuses on helping clients find hope and balance in the face of crisis, trauma, and grief. She has worked with suicide, domestic violence, and sexual assault crisis hotlines, and also survivors of Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, and the Joplin tornado. Her book is Making Peace with Suicide. It's a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. And I'd like to welcome to the Beyond 50 radio program today our guest, Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell. Adele, thank you for joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm especially delighted to talk about a topic that needs to come out of the closet, so to speak, and some more light and understanding.
Now, do you feel this is something that seems to still be in the closet, as you were saying, that we're kind of overlooking this and just kind of maybe, as an ostrich buries its head in the sand, hoping that it just doesn't happen or that we have a direct relationship with something like this?
Well, I have two answers to that. The first one is that the World Health Organization will tell us that on average, every 40 seconds, there is a suicide across the globe. That's a lot of numbers and a lot of pain. In the U.S., the numbers are there's one suicide every 13 minutes. It is so prevalent, you know, and people are embarrassed. They'll say, oh, died suddenly. A woman I was working with, her husband died by suicide, and what they put in the paper was that he died at home, right? People don't want to talk about it because there's taboo, and the survivors are left thinking, oh, my God, what did I miss? Could I have done something else? There's the torment with that. It's very difficult. Look at Robin Williams, right? When he died by suicide, there were some national newscasters that came out and allowed that he was a coward, right? Now, first of all, I don't believe, we now know from the autopsy, I don't believe anybody who takes their life by suicide is a coward. Specifically, vis-a-vis Robin Williams, we now know it was Louis's body dementia that had driven him to that place. But he'd also had a history of addiction and depression. But it's pain. It's whether it's the farmers in India who've lost their crops, the men in Ireland when there was a big recession, a huge number of men took their lives, people with student loans, a woman in Spain who jumped off a balcony because her house had been repossessed because of all the crazy mortgage loan stuff. There are a lot of reasons people choose suicide.
You know, and you take a look at something like this, and it seems that maybe perhaps people strike out with an opinion like that because of the fear that it could actually happen next to them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, that's a very thoughtful and loving response, Daniel. And I think when people are scared of something, they do sometimes make what I would call, and I'm sure we've all done it, a bit of a ill-considered, less compassionate response to something. I think that's probably a very good point.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as you talk about the story of Robin Williams and that these newscasters, it's kind of a shame how broadcast journalism has what it's become in America in many ways, but the fact is that they go and they say something like that, and it puts an ugly taboo on something that, as broadcasters, they really don't have the training or understanding of what really causes somebody to do something as drastic as committing suicide.
Well, and that's true, but also you look at Robin Williams' daughter, I believe her name is Zoe, because of the social media response to her dad's death by suicide, and the kind of terrible commentary she was getting, she took herself off of social media for a short period of time. And then on the anniversary of her dad's death this past August 11th, once again, a week or two before, and I don't know for how long after, she also took herself off of social media because people made such terrible comments,
mm-hmm.
right? And whether it's the on social media, the anonymity of you could say anything, and if you're hurting, you can hurt someone else. But suicide, it's been around since the beginning of time. You know, in ancient Rome, if you lost a battle, you came back and you took your life. And in Japan, there was harikiri, you know. In ancient times, older folks who felt their lives were older would put themselves on the ice floe. You know, there have been all, suicide covers a lot of ground, you know. It can be a considered choice to sometimes young people all fired up on drugs and alcohol with a heart full of pain. It can be an impulsive move, right? It's not just one thing.
Mm-hmm. I know that personally I've had a direct experience with suicide many years ago, and I can tell you that from my experience, what it was very upsetting because of how it had affected my family. And so honestly, from my perception at that particular time, it's a little bit different now, but I felt that it was a very selfish act. And I'm sure that that's something that you encounter quite a bit in your experience, don't you?
You know, you're right, Daniel. And I get why it says, you know, how could you do this to your family? How could you do this to your loved ones? But for the person who is suicidal, their thinking becomes very tight and constricted. And I interviewed people, a lot of people for the book, and from family members who had lost someone, as well as people who had been suicidal and either were saved before they took the act or attempted the act and did not succeed, their definition of success. And one woman said to me, you know, why would they want anything to do with me, right? I want them to forget me as soon as possible. You know, it's why people don't leave notes. You know, some people, either their thinking is so scattered. So when it comes to being a selfish act, I think it's shifting the perception and understanding that suicide comes about from a tremendous amount of pain. And I think it's a counterintuitive thing, right? If we're in the same room, Daniel, and if I were to put a pillow over your face, you'd fight me, right? Because your primal instinct for life would take over and you'd go, what are you doing, you crazy person, right? I want to breathe. Well, that's why people reach out to suicide hotlines, right? Because there's a part of them wondering if there's another answer, another response, another resource, or something else for them, right? And people's minds get jumbled up by alcohol and drugs. Even, you know, I know the military gives out, you know, I recently did some research and they had given out anti-anxiety drugs to combat soldiers. And, you know, that complicates things and PTSD and all sorts of stuff. You're thrown into a terrible situation. You know, it's rough out there. The world is tough. And the kids who get bullied at school, right, and they just want to die. How could you do that to me, right? So it's not, I don't think they're thinking that they're hurting somebody else. They just want to get out of pain and take away, they're convinced they're causing problems for other people usually as well.
You know, and it's, I guess for me, it's an interesting way to put this, but your book becomes very refreshing because, again, much like death, it's something we don't feel that we should be talking about. And whoever decided to make up the rules, you know, it's like, well, wait a minute here. No, it happened. You can't just, you know, turn the corner. If the light goes up, there's no shadow there, and so therefore a shadow doesn't exist. But it's
right.
A very alarming subject for a lot of interesting reasons. One of them, for instance, I was just not too long ago watching a documentary on the plight of the Native American in North America.
Right.
And it's alarming to discover on reservations the level of teen suicides on reservations, and if people were to really look underneath that a little bit more, they would realize how horrendous the United States government still is towards these people. I mean, we're talking about sterilization, you know.
Yes,
you know, so you begin to see there's a lot of, excuse me for saying this, good goddamn reasons for wanting to check out of this world and hoping if there is a reincarnation that the next life might be a little bit kinder.
I understand exactly what you're saying. I just gave a presentation on suicide in Indianapolis, and what I'm trying to pull out while I'm talking to you is a statistic on the Native Americans that blew me out of the water. So here we go. Okay. American Indians make up the smallest U.S. ethnic group. Okay. And in a study, the American Indians have higher rates of death from tuberculosis, 500% higher, alcohol, 514% higher, diabetes, 177% higher, unintentional injuries, 140% higher, homicide, 92% higher, suicide, 82% higher than the average, 82% higher than every 13 minutes. Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know what, Daniel, in my book I talk about, I came to the conclusion from talking to all sorts of people in my own clinical practice of that there are three common elements of suicide. The first one is the obvious, which is pain, pain in any shape, form, or dimension. The second one is disconnection. You may have loved ones around you, but you don't necessarily see it or feel it. Remember Bradley Cooper's role in The American Sniper, and his last tour of duty, he comes home, and he calls his wife. He's sitting in a bar, and he says, "I'm home." And she's like, "What do you mean you're home? I'm home. Why aren't you here?" He says, "I needed a minute," right? That disconnection, even though you have people who care about you, you know, it's you don't feel connected. And then the last one is disenfranchisement, which is disconnection to the nth degree. And it's as if you have your nose pressed to the glass of the galaxy. You're watching the world go by, and you feel like you have no value, no worth, no meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those three elements, and when we talk about my friends in Europe call Native Americans the first Americans. I love that. Isn't that great, the first Americans?
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the plight of what they've endured and put through, marginalized, disenfranchised, it's horrifying. It's horrifying.
Mm-hmm. You know, even more so, a new memory is about to be stirred up that's pretty alarming when you look underneath the veil, as there is a new movie coming out now that's about the life of one gangster, Whitey Bulger, from Southie Boston. And back around 2000, I believe it was, I had interviewed an author of, it was more of an autobiography, if anything, it was called All Souls, A Family Story from Southie.
Okay.
And so here was a guy that grew up during the 1970s in Southie and was part of course, a very large Irish family of, what was it, 11 kids and a single mother. And had talked about Whitey Bulger quite a bit in his book. And during the 1970s, as he was living in this area, they had the highest rate of teen suicide in the United States. And
really?
A lot of it was because this guy was so powerful in Southie, this Whitey Bulger that's going to be played by Johnny Depp, that there was this secrecy that you weren't allowed to, you know, what happened in Southie stayed in Southie. You know, and
wow.
It went to your grave. And
right.
So there was, as you're saying, you know, there was so much, call it, apathy could be considered part of it, but what was causing the pain was the feeling that there was no way out of the situation they were in.
Right, right. And that's when, you feel like there, before we had our call, I'm on a phone call with a client of mine, who is in a bad place and, you know, told me last night he was traveling on business. He was looking to see if the hotel room was, if he was up high enough, if he could leap, right? He was in a terrible, terrible place. When you feel you have no meaning or no connections, you know, it's a place you go. Now, there's also people who suffer profound mental illness, right? And their thinking is skewed. I remember speaking in Boston, interviewing a gentleman, and he told me when he was in high school, he came home, and it had been snowing that day, and so he got something to eat. You know, typical kid, he comes home from school, gets something to eat, but he's a good kid. He goes, oh, let me go to the basement, and I'm going to go get the snow shovel, and I'm going to go shovel because we've got a fair amount of snow. And he goes downstairs, and he finds his dad who has hung himself, and he said, that is the day I became a man. That is the day. And I said to him, and I already knew the answer to this because just the way he was talking. I said, did your dad leave a note? And he said it was all gibberish. And it turned out to be the exact word that many people used with me, of family members and loved ones who were suffering haywire neurochemistry, right? You know, they were profoundly distressed, and their thinking was exceedingly chaotic. And they couldn't organize their thoughts, so they would leave gibberish and a note in an attempt to leave something for their family. But it just indicated how much internal confusion was going on and what have you. And another woman told me the story of her son, and he heard voices in his head, and the voices told him he was the last living person on earth, and that he needed to kill himself so he could join his family. And his grandmother found him and got him treatment and help. But then, those are severe cases, but I'll share with you, someone I have worked with over the summer had experienced a lot of profound losses in her life. She had some depression and anxiety, but then it became like a runaway train, and then she wasn't sleeping. And when you don't sleep for a long period of time, it is crazy making. And so she's up in the middle of the night trolling the internet for possible ways to take her life. And not that she got beyond the thinking, but the thinking that she was going to plan it, but she'd also lost her spouse to suicide, so this was not new material for her. That the not sleeping, what I find is with people, depression and anxiety, and this show is the over 50, and had a conversation with this wonderful man from physician from Dartmouth. And we were on the AARP radio station. We were talking about the depression and suicide and how with people over 50 and their depression and anxiety, if it goes unchecked and there's not enough sleep, you can get to, not always, a psychotic place, right, where your thinking is irrational. It's crazy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at which point, you know, you need to get help. You know, you need to be evaluated for medication, not to say medication for forever in your life, but you'll need some medication to reclaim yourself. And if you don't, you mentally lose ground. Mm-hmm. So it's important to know that we're in looking out for ourselves and our loved ones, that sleep is really, really important. And if depression and anxiety have gone on for a while and untreated, then you need to talk to somebody about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, does that actually help to reach out to someone, say, like yourself, or a crisis hotline and maybe take one step at a time? How often or how well does that work?
Well, you know, I worked on a crisis hotline 18 years ago when I was in college, so really 18 years ago. And it was the first paraprofessional line they were starting in the country. So by today's standards, we didn't get a lot of calls, but, you know, we did get calls. And people called and reached out. And because it's, again, that struggle with taking your life, sometimes you think, oh, I shouldn't be here. And somebody says, no, wait. And I'll tell you, Daniel, I was young. I was a senior in college. I'd been trained to do this, but I was young. What did I know of the world, right? And the way we did it then is not the way I would do it now. The way we did it then was, this is before cell phones and GPS and all this stuff. This is in the early 70s. And the was to find out where they were, and then I would flag someone. I was hooked into one of those switchboards that was like a spaghetti thing with all the wires on it, right? The old guys. And they would let the police know my location or their location, and the police would go get them. And then the police were supposed to take them to a hospital where they'd be evaluated both physically and psychologically. But of the guys I all talked to, and they were all men who called, they all wanted to come meet me. And one of my, you know, great regrets is that I didn't hug them all and say, thank God you're alive, because that's what I would do now. But I was young, and they were all older. I was so convinced they were going to be furious at me for the police coming, right? And because, you know, they don't call the police. Of course I was. We were calling the police. We were going to get, we wanted them to be safe, and we wanted them to be alive. Now when I work with people, I'm very upfront. We have total trust on what's going on. You know, that's like the gentleman who called me up one night and said, Adele, I'm going to chop off my penis with a knife. I said, oh, okay, well, it doesn't sound like a really good idea to me. I'm thinking maybe it's time for you to be in the hospital. And he says, I don't want to go. I said, I understand. I know you don't want to go, but I want you to be safe. And I don't think you're safe right now. And so, you know, we got him into the hospital. But not everybody is at that extreme when they're thinking about suicide. And sometimes you have to know that somebody cares, or that there's some resources, there's, you know, there's even now, there's a text line for young people, a crisis text line, 741-741, for so that people could text for help. And then I wrote an article about this, and so I texted the number to make sure it was real, right? I didn't want to make something up. So let's find out if this is real. And very definitely, very real, and, you know, people respond on the other end. But you go on the web, and there's so many resources out there. And also, for family members who've lost someone to suicide, they're automatically put in a category of high risk, because whatever they've experienced, if they have a memory or their mind has created something, it's, you know, terrible stuff to witness or clean up, and or their own guilt, the taboo has been broken. It's complicated grief. Grief is hard. Grief makes us crazy anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Joan Didion in her book, A Year of Magical Thinking, you know, talked about somebody would just put, you know, a sandwich and a cup of tea by her just to remind her that she needed to drink and eat. It can make you crazy. So when you lose someone, sometimes you think, well, maybe I'll follow suit. And unfortunately, many people do, which is why, for a loved one who has lost someone, you know, they go gently and carefully, and hopefully they get some help and support as they make sense of the unsensible.
Now, it seems suicide, for me, the biggest thing seems to be a loss of hope. But that's pretty much across the board, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the hopelessness and the despair, it's like you have no options. There's no possibility. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to look forward to. And, of course, it depends on how you perceive your world.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some people always see the glass half empty, and some people see it half full. But when you get to that place, and circumstance can do it, because I always think that suicide is a confluence of stressors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you just get to that one last stressor, and you think, oh, my gosh, I there's no more hope. I can't do this anymore. And that's what happens. So,
I thought I'd bring that up because it reminded me of the late actor James Doohan, who played Scotty on Star Trek, the original series.
Right.
And he was describing a time that he was at a Star Trek convention, and this young girl came up to him and says, you know, I traveled a couple of states over to come and see you, and, you know, and so my dream has come true. And for some reason he said there was sort of a feeling inside that there was something off about this meeting with this young girl. He says, well, you know, in about 2 weeks I'm going to be here, and I would like if you would come to that convention, you know, I'll let you in, and then we'll be sure that we talk for a little bit afterwards. And she says, okay. So 2 weeks later, she showed up, and sure enough, he followed through on his word, and he says, you know, in about 4.5 weeks, I'm going to be doing another convention over in this place, and if you could, why don't you come and see me, and maybe we can also go out and have lunch as well. So this went on for about 5 years. And during this course of time, this young girl managed to get herself a bachelor's in engineering.
Uh-huh.
And it was after 5 years of this self-improvement that she finally came clean and said, the reason I came to see you that first time is because I was going to commit suicide after seeing you. And that was the one thing I wanted to do before I left this world. Can you imagine that? And that's why I bring up the idea of hope, that sometimes things can seem so unbearable. But, you know, how does one actually step forward and say, you know, I think I could take one more step. I think I can do one more thing. But the biggest thing is I have to be able to reach out to someone somewhere that can help me do this. And to not be afraid to ask for help, the biggest thing.
Right. Well, that's a great story. And I have a smaller version of that, which is I've had the great opportunity to be a volunteer with the Red Cross Disaster Mental Health, and I was helping out with the tornado in Joplin. Before I went, I went to Kohl's and I bought a plastic purple watch because I needed something that could endure anything because conditions were going to not be great. And I'm in the shelter, and I meet this young woman and her mother, and she says, oh, I like purple. And something, you know, just the little voice inside, the intuition, like this, the guy who played Scotty. I took off the watch, and I gave it to her. And then several years later, a couple years ago, on Facebook, she finds me on Facebook, and she sends me a private message, and she says, I just wanted to tell you that I was going to kill myself that day, but because you gave me the watch, I didn't. Did I have a clue? No, I certainly didn't have a clue. But I just knew that it felt right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, with the guy who played Scotty on the original Star Trek, I'm guessing on some level, perhaps even unconscious, he recognized something and he followed his good intuition or his heart or his instinct, whatever language we want to use. And what a fabulous, fabulous thing it is. We don't realize the power of one, right?
It certainly is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I was hoping for our listeners out there, Adele, that you might be able to share a website where they can find out more about the book. And, you know, there certainly is a lot of resources there for people as well.
Sure. I've got lots of resources for you. The website is makingpeacewithsuicide.com, makingpeacewithsuicide.com. And I also have another one in my name, Adele Ryan, R-Y-A-N, McDowell, M-C-D-O-W-E-L-L, AdeleRyanMcDowell.com. And those are two ways to find me in Amazon in terms of the book for anyone who's interested.
Very good. I think it's important that all of us take a look at this so that we get a feel and a better understanding of what it is, that it's not as linear and one-sided and black and white as it seems to be, that there's a lot more to it, and it's because of coming to educate yourself better about this, perhaps that little alarm will go off when the subtle signs begin to show up that you might be able to intervene and guide someone in a different direction. Perhaps that someone could be you.
That's so right. I think suicide is ultimately a lesson in compassion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether how we treat the homeless, somebody who thinks differently than we do, how we are to one another, right? How we are as a society as well as individuals.
Very much so. Again, the book is Making Peace with Suicide, a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. Our guest today, Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell. Dr. McDowell, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. This has been a great show and a distinct honor to be with you today.
I feel the same way about you as well. It takes a lot of courage to talk about something like this.
Yes, it does.
Again, go ahead and give your website out again one more time.
Makingpeacewithsuicide.com.
Very good. Thank you for joining us again.
Okay, thank you. Take good care. Bye-bye.
We want to thank you, the listeners out there, for tuning in. You can discover more by visiting us at beyond50radio.com. That is the number 50. Sign up for our free weekly e-news updates. You can also follow us on Twitter at beyond50radio, as well as like us on Facebook. I'm Daniel Davis. Thank you again for joining us.
This is the Beyond 50 radio program, and remember, live your day past halfway.